Kate Arrington, and you're listening to the Steppenwolf Theatre Company podcast.
This is literary manager Joy Meads, and I'm here in conversation with Malcolm Ewan, who is currently stage managing our production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Hello, Malcolm.
Hi, Joy. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm pretty well.
So, Malcolm, you've been with the company for a long time. Can you tell us what your first Steppenwolf show was and what your role has been here over the years?
Sure. I started, the first show I did at Steppenwolf was in 1987. It was Frank Galati directing a production of Born Yesterday. Mm-hmm. I came over from the Goodman, where I was one of the head stage managers. Actually, that season, I did two shows at the Goodman and two shows at Steppenwolf. I did the fall show, which I think was Peter Barnes' Red Noses at the Goodman. And then as soon as that closed, I started Born Yesterday. And then I did The Common Pursuit, which Rondi Reed directed here at Steppenwolf. And then I went back to the Goodman to do a production of A Flea in Her Ear. And the next year is when I switched over to Steppenwolf full-time with the production of The Grapes of Wrath in the fall of 1988.
And did you go with that play to Broadway?
Yeah, we did it in a number of locations, in fact. Uh-huh. We did it actually, we rented the Royal George Theater because it was too big for the old Steppenwolf, which was the 2851 North Halsted, was the 200. We used to call it the bowling alley. It wasn't really a bowling alley, but it had very low ceilings and was about 60 feet wide. And so you had everything was kind of very shallow, the sets, and very wide. But you couldn't do a show with 41 actors in it at that space with a 9-foot high ceiling. So we rented the Royal George, and we did it in the fall of 88, as I said. And then in the spring of 89, we took it to the La Jolla Playhouse in a sort of co-production and basically rewrote the show for that production. Mm. And then it went to the National Theatre in London for a 2-week festival called International. And then the next year in 1990, we took it to Broadway.
That's one of the most famous productions, I think, in Steppenwolf's history. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like to be part of that? What was that whole experience like?
It was wild. It was huge. It was bigger than the theater was really had ever done before because they didn't have the technical capability to do a show of that size and with that sort of technical complexity. We had terrible trouble all through the tech period in the Chicago production. You know, the truck, the Joge truck, notoriously broke down all the, you know, throughout the tech period and the whole run of the show in Chicago. It broke down all the time, and the actors would have to push it off stage. And it ran on a track. It had a sort of trolley that ran under the stage, and people ever saw the show, the truck didn't behave realistically. It behaved in a stylized fashion, meaning it didn't, you know, the wheels didn't turn when you turned the steering wheel, and it actually had a pivot point. So it moved right and left on this sort of trolley underneath the stage, and then it spun around on like a pole, like an axis. Mm-hmm. But it would get stuck, and the actors would shoulder up to it and push it off stage when they needed to. We had all these weird technical effects. There were actually fire pits on stage with real fire, three of them. We had flying pieces. We had all kinds of stuff. We had four live musicians. And, you know, people sang songs. There were big scene changes of sort of low-tech things, but trying to coordinate 40 people carrying, you know, each of them carrying a suitcase and a bundle on, and each of them having, beside the Joad family, who were 8 or 9, 10 strong, counting the kids, you know, so you had 30 other people in the show, all of whom had 10 or 15 parts to play.
Yeah.
And you know, they all had costume changes for all these things, and they all had different props. And at any rate, you know, Steppenwolf was a very small organization, very focused, very fun to work at, and very, you know, when you're working with people who've worked together as much as the sort of older ensemble has, you know, Gary and Terry, the first day of school is what I call the first day of rehearsal, because everyone is, whether they're either still auditioning for the part or whether they, you know, feel at ease in a room that they're not familiar with, none of that happens between longtime ensemble members. I mean, they may have fought bitterly over something and may not like each other even, but they understand how to work together. And, you know, listening to Gary and Terry in the first production of Grapes of Wrath, doing that opening scene where Preacher Casey's playing the harmonica and Tom Joad walks up, it was easy conversation. It was easy for them to be those people with a long relationship. You'd have to build the relationship very much between them, because they'd worked together for, at that point in the you know, late 80s, they'd worked together 12 or 15 years. And the foundation of that relationship was already there.
So, Mal, for those people who might not have ever been inside of a rehearsal room before, can you tell us what it is that a stage manager does?
Sure, I hope so. I've done it for a long time. The stage manager is basically the organizational and communications head of a specific production. And by that I mean the team of stage managers, usually comprised of, at Steppenwolf, on the main subscription series, an equity head stage manager and equity assistant stage manager, equity being the actors union, and a non-union stage management apprentice. And the three of us will divide up the tasks of organizing the effort on the production. And we're in charge of keeping the records, basically, making sure we know what the staging is. We need to know where the lights change, where the props are put out, all that kind of stuff that doesn't really occur to you when you don't, if you're not really working on a production. That if you're an actor, you can imagine this, I'm sure. It's kind of like when you go home and if you don't put your keys in the right spot, you know, get ticked off that you can't find them. Well, imagine an actor who's already trying to remember a prescribed set of words and not being able to find the prop, or the prop is set backwards that they expect to pick it up, you know, in a certain direction, and they have to fuss with it more, and it distracts them. So what we try to do is ensure that everything is the same every performance, and that as much as we can, we think ahead to try to ward off any interruptions in that sort of sameness of production. Now, obviously, stuff breaks or people forget things or, you know, things go wrong. But you try to work against that, try to mitigate any of that kind of stuff. And as we sit in rehearsal, we record the blocking, the staging. We prompt the actors when they're learning their lines. We they'll say line and we'll give them the words that they forgot. We will take line notes when we don't call for the line, and to tell them what lines they messed up on. We try to keep track of who changes costume when and where and how long they have, because sometimes costumes are put together differently or rigged differently. If an actor makes an exit on stage right and has to come back on stage left in 45 seconds in a new costume, that may not be possible, depending on the set, but also we need to tell the costume people that whatever that person is wearing needs to be what we would call quick-rigged, so that it can come off basically with Velcro or snaps or something, and it can just be pulled off them, and maybe they're underdressed in the costume that they come back on in or something. But it doesn't matter how what you actually do to achieve the effect. You just need to know that it's coming.
I've compared it in the past to, it's kind of like being the conductor of any individual performance. And you have to have a sense of, you have to be an bit of an artist, I think, to be a good stage manager, to have a sense of the rhythms and the flow of the piece that you're calling.
Oh, definitely. You have to get inside the head of the piece. And that's one of the reasons why it's important that you're there in the rehearsal hall every day, mm-hmm. to listen to the director talk to the actors and to listen to the director and the designers talk about how that light cue or that sound cue sort of folds in or lands in a specific moment in the play. And I've worked a lot with this great lighting designer who works here all the time named Jim Ingalls. Mm-hmm. And he will often tell me what the cue is for. Mm-hmm. It's for, you know, clove coming in, appearing in the door. Mm-hmm. He doesn't necessarily tell you where it is, mm-hmm. but he wants that the light to break. You know, it's for this. And sometimes if it's just, you know, but knowing that and knowing what the idea of it is can help you shape how you call it and where mm-hmm. you say go.
Well, speaking of the magic of live theater and the things that, you know, make each performance different from the next, I'm sure in your time at Steppenwolf, you can remember, you know, some extraordinary nights where things, everything just seemed to be hitting it exactly right, and some nights where nothing seemed to go quite right. And I'm wondering if you have any specific stories that you could share with us of either one or the other.
You know, there have been a lot of good nights like that. I did a couple shows here with the Ladysmith Black Mbazo were in, The Song of Jacob Zulu and Noma Temba. The last 5 minutes of The Song of Jacob Zulu with K. Todd Freeman playing the title character were riveting. And you those were highlights. But, you know, there have been so many. Rondi Reed and The Rise and Fall of Little Voice coming out. I mean, you know, one of the great things about working here is that my sort of memory attic is full of little nuggets of memories that of individual moments that worked well. The moment that John Malkovich in The Libertine started, it was kind of this odd conceit in that you kind of saw backstage and you saw the crew. All through the show, the crew walked out and did things, and you saw the idea was to have like a tiring house, I think Terry Johnson, who directed, called it. And you saw like a changing area off stage left, and the crew was playing cards with the cast before the show. And John would sometimes bring his kids out, who were quite small at the time, and he would talk on his cell phone, you know, while he was standing on stage prior to the show. And then at one point I would walk out, I was stage managing, and I'd say, okay, here we go. Mm-hmm. And I would walk back to, I was calling the show from the wing, and I would walk back and John would start this, you know, 5-minute monologue that begins, "You will not like me."
Yeah.
Let's see if there's anything else. Well, I mean, there have been so many great moments, some of which I experienced as the production manager when I was production manager for 3 years.
That's right, and you were the production manager when we moved into the theater, this theater.
That's correct. This building is
1650. Yeah.
It was right after the Grapes of Wrath, and it was the fall of 1990. I started, and we were building the building. It opened in the spring of 91, and basically, I considered it to be stage managing our way into the new building. Mm-hmm. But I had sort of. Because Steppenwolf had a scene shop, we were an unusual architectural client or a construction firm client because we could produce things like the counters and the coat racks. We weren't going to buy them. We fabricated them. And we also had people who were capable of doing, of sealing floors and painting railings and things like that beyond the building trades. And we made a deal, you know, anything that was Bruce Sagan, who was our board chair at that point, worked almost on a daily basis with Kevin Rigdon, who was our resident designer at the point, and myself. We'd meet every morning, and we would I had a crew of ranging between 5 and 9 people working in the building beyond the construction crews, and we did a lot of that sort of finished work ourselves. And we, of course, once we took over the building, you know, there was a lot of operational stuff to take charge of, running the heating and ventilating, all that kind of stuff. It was a big task to try to get into the building. You know, crews sometimes, we discovered the floor wasn't completely level and the first show had a turntable. And so the turntable, the way it was engineered, didn't have enough, couldn't overcome the inertia of trying to go uphill. So we had to re-engineer it, which meant that for the first, we had an extra week of previews because we knew there would be some problems, but for the first five or six previews, we actually had to push this big turntable by hand, which didn't look very good in the new building. But and then it was re-engineered to be able to cope. But it was a retrofitting something in the middle of a tech period or a preview period was kind of a pain. So.
I want to thank you so much, Malcolm, for coming to talk to us today.
Great. It's been a pleasure.
If you'd like to join us for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, you can buy tickets at www.steppenwolf.org, where you can also learn about the rest of our programming.